Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's May 23rd, 2014. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Hey! How's the cruise?
I'm still Scott Long. When does he get back again?
Not soon enough.
All right.
So it's so nice to have you back on the show. In consecutive weeks, our fans must be just going crazy.
I'm sure the response has been over the top. I can't wait to see the numbers.
But I am glad that you're on, because I promised last week I would bring this up, and I really want to get your take on it, considering that you've obviously been part of this streak that we are on, if that's even the right word to use.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm going to Italy, as you have been there many times, and this will be my second time, and the wife and I are going to go for a month. We're going June 18th to July 18th.
Nice long trip.
Yeah, actually a week of that we're going to spend in Paris, but we're going to wrap it up coming back to Rome before we fly home. So one of the things I said to Scott was, you know, inevitably we're going to have to miss a week of our show. I mean, it's going to happen. Something tragic's going to happen. you know, I mean, whatever it is, I don't know. I mean, the computer's going to crash. Something's going to happen one of these days where we're going to have to miss a week. And he's like, well, I don't know. And so he's doing everything he can, including making up rules and things that don't apply to rational people, to make this streak happen. So this is what he wants to do, and I want to get your take on it. So during the time that I'm gone, there are going to be no shows posted. But before I leave, we have asked the listeners of the show to please submit their five favorite episodes, or at least the episode that they would most want to hear if they had to repeat listening to the show. And what we'll do is we'll pick the five most voted for, or the top five, and we will sort of update it. Like, in a sense, we'll sort of give our reaction to that episode, what we thought that episode, you know, about it, or what it entailed, or whatever. And then we're going to post all five of those shows at once before I leave. And Scott has going on this, you know, binge thing. You know, all these shows now, they're doing binge watching on Netflix and, you know, A&E or whatever.
And ice cream, yeah.
Exactly. So for him, he feels like, in his own irrational way, that he is preserving this streak that he and I and you have kept alive for the past 9 years almost. What do you think about this? Do you think that he's just being crazy and we should just say, hey, let's just take the break and don't worry about it?
No, I like what Scott's come up with. Because if you think about it, Johnny Carson was the host of The Tonight Show from 1962 to 1992. Uh-huh. And when he wasn't there, they still had a Tonight Show. Sometimes it was a repeat. Sometimes it was a guest host. And I don't think anybody would ever argue that meant that he was not there for those 30 years. So I think this keeps the streak intact. I mean, you guys are entitled to a week off every 5 years or whatever it's been. I don't have a problem with that.
Well, let me ask you for a definition of streak then. Because for me, when we say never missing a week in 9 years or since 2005... we're missing 5 weeks just because we taped five shows and posted them all in one day.
Well,
it's not,
I mean,
five shows. We've missed a week.
Johnny Carson took lots of vacation time. I don't know if you you're old enough to remember Johnny Carson.
Yeah, of course I am. I love that show. But listen, that's not the point, though. I mean, he took vacations. He didn't say he had a streak. He just said he was the host from then to then. We can still say that.
What I would do is I'd just say, okay, here are the five shows for the 5 weeks we're gone. And then I would tag each one of them with a date, you know, so that they run consecutively and every week is covered. And then just spew them all out and be done with it. And the streak is intact.
The streak is intact.
The one I want to hear is the very first show. Do you guys still have that?
Oh, yeah. I've got them all in my computer somewhere.
That first show was about, what, 10 minutes?
Six.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, it's less than 10 minutes.
Well, I don't care what else you do. You have to redo that show.
Redo it or just run it again?
Well, no, just run it. Yeah. Like a 30-second intro, because that was one of the funniest shows ever.
I know. I mean, the entire show, we're like, and so this is what we think of Boger. We're so monotone. It's like crazy. And the dings and all that stuff are still part of it, I think, too, the background.
The elevator, you mean?
Yeah, I think that's still. Oh, yeah. I think it's actually in show one, but I'm not positive. No, actually, show one was the microwave ding because we didn't get to the elevator till later. They gave us an office later, like in the back corner of the Times, yeah. Eighth floor. Yeah. But in the beginning, it was the microwave ding. People coming and reheating their lean cuisines while we're doing the show. So.
Yeah, I want to hear that show again. I really do.
I was telling Scott, I had a feeling one was going to be asked for the most. That, and I thought people would bust our chops and ask for Pod Odds, but
well, Pod Odds is a classic. I'm not tooting my own horn, but I enjoyed that show where Scott and I went to Niagara Falls.
Yes,
and we had that adventure at the border.
That's a real good one.
Then but speaking of Scott,
yes.
Can I change the subject?
Absolutely, I'm ready to move on.
I thought about Scott the other day. Believe it or not, when I was in the shower, because
not the first time, I'm sure.
Scott comes up with all these crazy ideas, and I thought of a time-saving idea. If you put one bar of soap in each hand while you're taking a shower, you can cover the same amount of skin in half the time. Isn't that something that Scott would have come up with?
Either that or it would have been something from Seinfeld when Kramer... Remember when Kramer, did you ever watch that show? And Kramer couldn't take a shower in less than a half an hour, and he started combining tasks. And then that's when he starts making salad in the shower, and he puts a disposal in the drain. And
I gave it a test run the other day.
And it worked?
I had two bars of soap. You know how when you run down on one bar of soap, you get another bar of soap?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how you do it, but I tend to try to squeeze the bars of soap together to make a new one big bar of soap. But for some strange reason yesterday, I used both bars of soap at the same time, and I was in and out of there in a flash, and I think it's something we should think about.
That is awesome, because Seinfeld told Cosmo to use gravity. Just let the suds go down. Don't have to wash each individual piece, you know. So, well, this is great. I'm glad you came up with the non-poker, because I was feeling pressure to do it myself.
Yes.
I was thinking about telling the duck pin bowling story that you begged me to tell.
Oh, that was a good one.
Seven years ago. I haven't told that yet, so maybe someday I still will. But since you saved me with the shower idea.
Scott's in Europe still, right?
Yeah, still there.
And he was in Amsterdam, I'm guessing, right?
He's going there. I don't know if he went already, but yeah.
Now, I know Scott is happily married to the lovely Mrs. Laura Long.
Right.
But I was thinking the other night, can you imagine Scott wandering around in the red light district of Amsterdam saying to himself, wow, look at these ladies. Some of these ladies don't have any clothes on. What's going on with that? I mean, there's no street like this in Columbus.
Columbus.
I wonder if they take coupons.
Hey, I got this Anthony Curtis Amsterdam advisor, 2-for-1. You girls up for that? You don't really think Scott's naive to the ways of Amsterdam and the red light district, though, right? I mean, he's got to know what he's getting himself into.
He's a pretty sophisticated guy. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
Okay. That should be fun. Well, you know damn well that, like, the next 6 years of shows are going to be dedicated to this trip that he's taken.
All the strange things they do in Europe that he can't figure out why they do it that way, you know.
Exactly. What's up with this plug in the wall? It's
it's got three prongs.
I can't put my three prong into the two holes here. I mean, I just rip off this ground part here and shove it in there. It should work.
What happened to the bottomless cup of coffee that I get at home?
What do you mean you don't have Pabst Blue Ribbon? All right, well, I think we've wasted enough poker, non-poker time here. Let's get to our listener spotlight. You know, each week we spotlight a listener who calls our hotline, 206-338-6344, or emails us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we'll do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we send them something fantastic. This comes from Guy Taws. He says, I've been a recreational poker player for a couple of years, and I'm looking to move up a level or two this year after a profitable 2013. I'm making sure that I read as many books as I can to enable me to keep learning. Most of the books I've read have helped me to improve in one way or another. However, the last two I've read have concentrated on mathematical things such as ICM and equilibrium. I've tried to take in everything in the books, but I find that most of it goes over my head. How important is it to be able to grasp a more complex mathematical side of poker? If I keep reading the books over and over again, will I finally be able to get to grips with it? If not, will I ever be able to compete with the bright young guns of internet poker? Is 36 too old to try to get started in poker nowadays?
36, yeah, it's too old.
Yeah, forget it.
I think you should quit.
36 is way too old to listen to this show, that's for sure. I know you've got a response.
Well, my response is that mathematics, is it necessary? Yes, but I would put it in another term, arithmetic. That's about where I'm at, arithmetic. You need to know arithmetic. I was looking through one of my favorite poker books the other day. It's called Every Hand Revealed by Gus Hansen.
You wrote a review of that for our first
issue. Yeah, their first issue.
Yeah.
Back in 2008,
yep.
I think it was. And I was thumbing through that again, and I looked through some of his hands, and what he does is he calculates the blinds and annies, the amount he would have to pay to win the pot, what's his equity, and whether or not he should call based on what his holdings are and what he thinks the opponent has. And, you know, he goes through this very quickly in his mind. Obviously, he's in a tournament setting throughout this whole book. But to me, that's about where I want to be as far as the end point. I want to make sure I'm making good decisions based on the arithmetic of how much is in the pot. And it makes a big difference whether there's annies in a tournament, for example, or not. It makes it much more profitable to enter pots when the annies kick in. And so you see people, like he says, playing the same style of poker pre and post ante, and they are really missing a huge advantage they could be getting for themselves. So, I mean, adding up what's in the pot, what you would put in to call a raise, and then calculating, you know, your likely chance of winning the hand. To me, that's about as far as I go on math. And as I say, that's more arithmetic than math. But this question reminds me of people trying to climb up the ladder. I played chess for a while, and I mean, I still know how to play chess, obviously. But right. I played in tournaments and online for many years. And it was always clear to me that I was never going to be a master at chess. A, I didn't have the innate talent, and B, I just didn't put the hours in. Right. And so any of your listeners who are chess players will know this term. I was my highest rating was about 1850, 1860. And to get to expert level, you need to get to 2000, and then to master level is 2200. And it's very hard to get that master rating. Right. And I never was going to do that. And I, you know what? I was okay with that. I'd rather do a lot of things in kind of a half-assed way than focus intensely on trying to, you know, climb up into the elite of something. Frankly, I don't have the time to do that. So for me, as a recreational player, I want to make the right decisions based on the arithmetic, but I'm not certain that you need to get as far into the weeds as it sounds like he's getting.
You lost me a long time ago when you said something about equity. I mean, I don't even pay attention to that stuff anymore. I have like the Sesame Street way of you do arithmetic, I do Sesame Street math. You know, I look at my pile, and I look at the pile in the middle, and I say, I can sacrifice a little portion of this pile to win that pile. It looks pretty good. I think that's a good enough. I'm seeing some flops, you know. But you're right. I've never been a math type person, and I know that if Gundam is still listening to us, what he's going to be thinking, and he thinks that everything is math because your decisions in your mind are still math, and I understand what he means by that. But most people think of it as the numbers part of it and not just the weighing of the likelihoods of things as math. So, but when you talk about the being good at a lot of things but not being great at anything, I mean, I like to think of that way too. I like to think of, you know, like I'm into a lot of different things. I'm into astronomy now. I'm into, you know, I've gotten back into bowling again. You know, poker.
Yeah, I mean, I like ping pong, backgammon, swimming, chess, poker, painting landscapes. There's a lot of, and all of it I do in a half-assed way.
Right.
It still makes me happy.
Exactly. And that's what's the most important thing. And that gets to the root of it when he asks, you know, is 36 too old? You're never too old to do anything you enjoy. If you enjoy it, then why would you be too old? So, and 36, certainly not. I mean, I seem to recall it was either a, I think it might have been like Norman Chad saying it, but somebody might have said it on one of the poker shows saying that, you know, at 50, the mind starts to, you know, not be as sharp as it could with remembering things or whatever.
And another word for that is the mind starts to
start.
I can attest to that.
But, you know, and then but the reason why they were bringing it up is because they were looking at how amazing Doyle Brunson is still going.
Yeah.
You know, he's practically 80 now. And, or if you think he is 80 now, he's like right there. So, you know, for them to, you know, to say, oh, he's 36 too old. Well, this guy's still, you know, just because he's got it in the back of his head and he's an expert at his whole life, but he's still got to be deteriorating and yet he's still playing at the best level. So 36 to try to get started? I don't think so. And he already said he had, Gus here already said that he had a profitable 2013. So clearly it wasn't too late for him to get into it because it's not easy to always have a profitable year, especially if you're just starting out. So, but I do know what he's talking about when he says the books that he's read have just been over his head. You know, I mean, I read The Theory of Poker and, it, you know, I got a lot of it, but it was just, it's just way too much work for me to have to apply all that stuff to the home game. You know, I'd rather just be hanging out with my friends and know that we're all pretty much on the same level. And, you know, certain games, some are better than others, whatever. But, you know, we're either going to win $20 that day or we're going to lose 50 or 60 or we're going to win 60. You know, I mean, it's always somewhere in those median ranges where we're happy and we can walk away and not be miserable and know we had a good time. And that's what poker is for me. It's just enjoying what I'm doing and not worrying about ICMs and equilibriums.
Or ICBMs.
Gross.
No, intercontinental ballistic missiles.
I thought that was something that my grandkids play in the bathroom. Oh. All right, let's move on. We got our call the floor segment. You know, if you find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been, then you should email us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com, and we'll have Annie Up Poker Tour Tournament Director Sam Minatello tell you how he would have ruled. This comes from David DeAndrea. Could be Dandrea. I don't know. It sounds nicer the way I say it, so I'm hoping that's what it is. He says, we are in a 1-2 no-limit hold'em game in a Las Vegas casino. Player on my right raises to $20. I re-raise to $40. Now that original raiser pulls back his 20 and starts stacking the chips and staring me down for a minute or so, and then mucked. As the dealer started to shove the pot to me, I reminded him the player had bet and then pulled back his original wager of $20. He made the player put the $20 back. I thought the pullback should have been a raise, but the floor said otherwise.
Well, what do you think, Chris?
Well, I mean, I know that you know, Sam's got a nice, long, ready answer here, but I don't think it should have been a raise. He didn't do anything that indicated raise or call. He pulled his money back. You know, I mean, he just was an idiot about it. But, I mean, he didn't do anything that indicated that he should have been raising. He didn't push any money. He didn't say anything. He just pulled his chips around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It sounds like an angle shoot to me is what he was trying to do.
Well, I was going
to
say that. I see this a lot now, and I don't like it at all, where people are pulling back chips in anticipation of making a raise. It's just too it has too much potential for trouble.
Right.
I don't like that whole move of once the chips are in, I think they should stay in. I mean, if you want to raise, go ahead and put additional chips out there.
Yeah.
It's not that hard.
And the other thing, too, is why doesn't the dealer grab the stack? The minute I made it 40, he should have grabbed the 220s and put them in and said, there's the raise, 20 more.
Well, here's what Sam says. He says, once again, a big factor has to do with the dealer not paying attention. And I've said this myself. I mean, 95% of the dealers are great, but you do get that 1 in 20. And see, there's math again.
You did good.
The one I like, dislike, I guess, the best is the one who is dealing running the table, but his eyes are never on the table.
Yeah.
They're never on the felt.
Yeah.
He's looking around at different flat screens. He's checking out who's going on break. His eyes are shifting all over the room, but they're never on the table. So you always have to tell him what to do and whose action it is. And that bugs the hell out of me. But anyway, Sam says when anything unusual happens in a hand like this, everything needs to freeze and you call the floor. And as soon as that player tried to muck, they should have called the floor.
Yeah.
And he thinks the outcome of the ruling is based on the fact that the player who pulled back his chips no longer had a hand, which is why they didn't make him put in a raise. But Sam says, if facing a call, a player pulls back chips already in the pot, I would rule that that would be at least a call of 40. But when the hand has been mucked, it makes for a sticky situation. If the dealer would have asked the guy who pulled his chips what his intent was before he mucked, then you'd have a clear picture of what's going on. But and I think Sam, in what he says here, he says a lot of players don't realize what they're doing when they go into the tank. I think that's true. This might not have – probably wasn't an angle shoot, but I certainly can see it as an angle shoot. I would not be happy when someone had pulled their chips back after I had raised them.
Yeah. And you know, there's something else that I remember playing once, and it's sort of the exact opposite. It was a limped pot, and the big blind guy grabbed his chips. He was in a big blind, so it limped around to him. He grabs his chips and then casually throws them into the pot. Now, his blind was already out there, so he grabs the blind, throws them in the pot. Then the dealer does the flop, and as he's doing the flop, the guy who threw the big blind says, wait, 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 I was going to raise. And we're like, no, you can't raise. That's like the international accepted motion for here are my chips in the pot. I can't go back to my chips. You can't go back to them now. You've already thrown them into the middle. You've made your forward motion with your bet. You know, that's everyone thinks of that as go ahead, roll them, you know. And it's sort of the exact opposite here. It's instead of pulling them back and then – you know, trying to get away with it. He was throwing them out there and then, like, hoping to see some of the flop and decide if he wanted to raise. You know what I mean? It was just this weird thing. And just don't touch your chips at all. Once they're out there, leave them alone.
And don't splash the pot.
And definitely don't splash the pot.
Chris.
Me? I never splash the pot.
Okay. If you say so.
Catch me. Try to catch me doing it. Hey, we almost had a home game this weekend, too. Almost. We almost tried to pull one off, but we felt like it was too late. I think
I could have done it.
And Doc got the day off, and he texts me. He's like, hey, or he calls me on Wednesday. He's like, hey, would you mention the game on Saturday? And I'm like, sure, I guess. Yeah, all right, go ahead. And then I didn't hear anything from him.
Mm.
And then he's like, so I texted him late last night. I'm like, hey, it seems pretty late to try to get guys to commit to a game 3 days from now. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to take the day off, but maybe Monday? And I'm like, Monday? No, we don't have a game on Monday. So we almost had one, though. Then you could have tried to catch me in this. So, hey, you know, Mike, we get to complete an O'Malley's move. This is the first time you're actually going to complete one ever. Very exciting stuff, don't you think?
I'm looking forward to it.
All right, let's refresh our memory with part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we're playing 1-2 No Limit Hold'em, and we've already lost a buy-in. We rebought and currently sit with 175, down another 25. It's been a rough night. The table's action has been steady with a maniac or two, typical No Limit Hold'em. It gets folded around to the button, who makes it $7 to go. He's one of these maniacs. He's been running pretty good lately, and he currently has us covered with around 350. The small blind folds, and we look down in the big blind at the 6 of spades, 6 of clubs. This is worth a look at the flop, and we decide to make the call. With about $15 in the pot, the flop comes down the ace of hearts, 10 of spades, 6 of diamonds. This is an excellent flop for our hand, and since we're first to act, we decide to slow play a little. We check. Our opponent makes a $10 bet into the pot, and at this point, we're still in slow playing mode. We make the call. The turn brings the 5 of clubs. This is pretty much a blank. It doesn't change a whole lot. We elect to keep up our slow play and check. With $35 in the pot, our opponent makes a $15 bet. Once again, we simply call. There's $65 in the pot, and the river is the 4 of hearts. Hopefully he's got one more bullet in the chamber, because once again, we slow play and check. He wastes little time in betting $20 into the pot. After some thought, which I'll admit had an element of Hollywood, we end up making a raise to $40. At this point, with little hesitation, our opponent moves all in. What could he be playing here? Is there any logical hand that beats us? What's the move?
All right, what do you think?
Slow playing bottom set. What could possibly go wrong?
See, now you're getting just like me. You're all calloused and bitter because every hand is always a losing hand on these shows.
I went into this hand. I listened to the first half, like we just did, and I thought to myself, this guy has a the button has a range that basically is infinite. He's described as a maniac. It's folded to him on the button. He really doesn't need to have any kind of hand to go ahead and put in a raise to try to steal the blinds, does he?
No, not really.
Not really.
Not really.
So I'm okay with the call of the raise with the pair of sixes. I think that's perfectly fine. That's my play as well. When you come out and flop a set, however, and then you decide you're going to slow play it all the way to the river, I'm not so sure I would have done that. I thought about this hand in terms of a limit hand, which it isn't, but this was a limit hand, and I flopped that set. I would have check-raised the flop,
yeah,
bet out the turn, and then bet the river and called any raise on the river. So
yeah.
I'm not saying to use that as a template for this hand. I might well have – I wanted to ask you about this. What do you think – what's your opinion of the donk bet? That's the bet where you you've called a raise out of position, and then you lead into the flop.
I like it because I'm old school Doyle Brunson super system, and he's the one that says – if you have a razor preflop and you call a raise and you hit the flop hard, you should bet into them because they're supposed to have a hand there. And if they have a hand, they're going to fight back at you, and that's when you're going to get your most money. So
yeah.
I've almost – but this is a maniac, so maybe I change it up a little bit for this guy.
Yeah.
But generally, when people raise, most people play tag. They don't play maniac. So generally,
yeah,
people who are tight aggressive and they raise preflop, they have ace-king, they have ace, they have king, something like that. And if I'm playing 6-6 and I flop my set and he has king-king and it comes ace, you know, or whatever. And this flop was kind of bad for that kind of scenario. But yeah, I'm pro donk bet in that situation. Here, I'm not so sure.
Well, I think what I would have done was I'm okay with checking the flop and calling. By the time it gets to the turn, I really want to put some pressure on this guy and, you know, a hand like if he's got a two-pair hand or something,
uh-huh,
I really want to get more money out of him than I'm doing by just being passive. And so I might check raise the turn in this case.
Yes, I don't like the check raise on the flop, because a check raise on the flop will send him scurrying, because that's basically
when people
they wait for a maniac to bet, and then they raise him, and then that's how the maniac knows that you've gotten him beat, and he's going to let it go. So I like the just calling, and then on the turn, when he thinks you've missed whatever it is that you're trying to go for, like say you had king queen, you're hoping to get a gutter or something, then he bets again, then you raise him so you get some more money out of him, you know, because you've gotten that extra bet in. So,
but
I agree with you. I like the turn check raise if this guy is truly a maniac and he is going to keep betting. So,
yeah.
Okay, well, you know, I don't think I'm good enough to fold this. I mean, there are some boards, if they're a little more wet, as the kids say, I could do it. But with this board, I just, you know, well, I mean, unless he's got some, you know, one of those one time the maniac wakes up with a, you know, a pocket pair that's a bigger set than ours, I just don't see myself really folding here. And it's terrible because you know how these things go.
At Derby Lane, if this was a little old lady, I would instantly fold.
Oh, yeah, maybe, yeah.
So there's that, but
he's a maniac.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you fold, here's what you've done. You've flopped a set, you've check called, check raise, fold.
Yeah,
that's really not a profitable system.
Yeah, no, that's brutal.
So, I mean, you pretty much have to call here, and I probably would too, but I don't like it.
No. All right, well, let's see if there's some bad news for us. Here comes part two.
Hello again. What hands make sense here? Our opponent raised from the button, then bet on every street. I think we can rule out aces. This guy isn't going to bet out on a rainbow flop with top set. I think we can also rule out tens for the same reason. Maybe it's a set of fives or fours. It could even be a hand like ace 10. Maybe a big ace, like ace king, ace queen, or ace jack. I kind of feel like we're good here. After a bit of thought, we make the call, and our opponent turns over 8-7? Ugh. I did not see that hand coming at all. But we did give him every opportunity to get there. It still hurts. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, be careful when setting a trap. If you wait too long to spring it, your opponent might be the one getting the cheese while you end up with a broken neck. I hope to see you on the felt.
Brutal.
How do you put somebody on 8-7? Okay, so you did say earlier that this guy could have anything between, you know, any hand.
Deuce three to ace eight.
Yeah, he could have anything because he's a maniac. But
well, it's a button raise.
It's a button raise, but then he's still betting the whole way without even hitting his hand.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, yeah, okay, he's got a gutter, but
this guy fires two barrels with air, so
with just a gutter. That's it. And so for me, I'm thinking, lesson learned here, you know, wake up earlier in the hand when you got, you know, because that's why a lot of times when we play, I just fire when I've hit, because I'm going to get paid off most of the time anyway, and for the times I don't, then they didn't suck out on me, you know. Yeah. I mean, that's why I like to just be strong with my hands and be strong all the time when I'm playing, because otherwise this kind of crap happens. I mean, really, this guy had 8-7, he had no right to even be in the hand. But he played the person rather than, you know, or the situation, because he's supposed to do that. He's a good player, probably. But then to just keep firing, if we had shown any kind of strength at all before that river, this guy would have gone away, or at least paid. Like, if we had done it on the turn, you know, a big raise on the turn, he probably goes away for a gutter, probably, if it's a big raise. Or if we shove too, he's not calling. But
well, actually, he's open ended by that time.
Oh, because what was the turn? Oh, it was a five.
Turn was a five.
Okay, but even then, if it's a huge raise, does he stick around? Maybe. But on that flop, you know, it goes against.
Nothing on that flop.
On the flop, he's got nothing, and he bets. So slow paying is probably not a bad thing there. We talked about it before. If we don't want to lose the maniac, because you're not putting him on 7-8 there. And if you are, you definitely aren't raising because you think he's going to fold 7-8.
The other thing is, it's a heads up hand.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be a lot different if you had other players in the hand. Then you definitely would not slow play.
No, right, because you don't want to give multiple
but
cards.
But heads up, I can see it. But I actually wrote down 7-8 as one of the possible hands before I listened to the outcome, because I just thought there was such a wide range there. But really, you're looking at your best case scenario on this is that you're going to beat a two pair hand with like an ace six or something.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, kind of a thin reed to lean on with making that crying call on the river.
You know, and when you said 8-7, I always come up with the nuts when I'm trying to analyze these things.
Yeah.
But not because I want to fold, and not because, you know, it's the most logical hand, but it's just because most of these things, when the hands of the week come in and stuff, they're losing hands. So you think to yourself, oh, yeah. What is the most? But when I came up with 7-8, I'm like, come on. Did this guy really raise pre with 7-8 and then bet out with a gutter and then stick around and bet again when he was just open-ended, when we were showing that we weren't going anywhere? And maybe. I guess it kind of makes sense. But, yeah, at that point, when you get the 4-5-6 on board, and this guy's a maniac, maybe we just call the river, you know, and not lose our whole stack, you know, because he is a maniac. Anything could happen.
He's a maniac.
Hey, don't ever do that again.
Hey, this is AJ Benzer.
This is Justin Bonomo.
This is Downtown Chad Brown.
Hi, this is Clooney Gowan.
This is Daniel Negreanu.
Hey, this is David Singer.
This is Linda Johnson.
Hi, this is Greg Raymer.
Hi, this is Hoyt Corkins.
Hi, this is Cindy Violet.
Hi, this is John D'Agostino.
This is Joe Seabach.
This is Jennifer Harmon.
Yeah, this is Johnny Chan.
This is Cowboy Kenna James.
Hi, this is Mark Safe.
This is Paul Wasikin.
Hi, this is Miami Johnson.
This is Dola Brunson, and you're listening to Annie Up.
All right, it's time for Hand of the Week. Make sure you send your hands or situations to podcast@annieupmagazine.com. Don't forget, send us what you think the top five shows are that we should be playing on that, whatever that streak thing is that Scott's doing. But this is, I guess we call this the O'Malley portion of the show. He actually sends in a hand of the week for us, which is very good. It's actually a situation.
A sitch.
And I like these because I don't have to write anything down. He says, yeah, he had a little situation come up in a $50 sit and go, and they were down to four players from seven. Top two get paid. He was on the button, and it was fold to him, and we have ace-ace. So two players behind him are extremely tight, and they have no problem folding their blinds and just moving on to the next hand. So I know from experience, slow playing aces is always a bad idea. So is slow playing bottom set. but in this instance, I really think this is the only way I'm going to get anything out of them. The blinds at this point were 100, 200 with a 25 ante. And I was the big stack at the table with about 9K, or as Scott likes to say, squiggly 9K. Small blind folded and the big blind checked after I limped. Flop came Queen Jack 3, rainbow. Big blind led out for 300, exactly half the pot. I made it a grand and she called. She's a decent player. Her Omaha game is better than her Hold'em game, but she's no slouch at Hold'em. Maybe a little too tight. So now, with 2,600 in the pot, the turn is a 9, putting 4 suits on the board. But it's getting too coordinated for my liking. She checks, and so do I. At this point, she's got about 4K left. Perhaps I should have bet there. I was more concerned with pot control. The river was another queen, and she says, well, I have to bet, and since a proper bet would be more than 33% of my stack, I guess I'm all in.
She's really explaining it.
Yeah,
I was. Isn't she?
But what do you think when people do this kind of stuff at the table? What are you thinking?
Generally, they've got something.
Yeah. Yeah, he tends to agree. He says, this little speech screened strength to me. And once again, I wondered if I had let a hand like King 10 or Queen X run my aces down because I slow played them. Either way, I decided to fold. Face up, of course. She told me it was a good fold, but never showed her hand. I went out in fourth after a bad run of cards, and discussion stayed on that hand most of the night. The debate was whether my fold was good or not, not really taking into consideration if she really did have me beat, just if the fold in that situation was correct. On an interesting note, everyone at the table thought my preflop play was just fine considering how tight the blinds play. However, I am greatly second-guessing that now. What do you guys think? I have some stuff I want to say, but I want to hear your take first.
Well, never fold your hands face up. That's the first thing I'd say.
Okay.
Why are you checking the turn there? That makes no sense to me.
Yep.
And don't slow play aces. What is this? This is the slow play edition of Anti-Up. I mean, let's just make it very simple. If you have aces, just raise. Just always raise.
Yeah.
You will never make the wrong decision if you have aces and you raise. That's just, I just do not like that. I got into a habit, a bad habit, of slow playing ace-king by limping. And we had an old friend who has since passed away who used to do this.
Yeah.
And a couple of times it worked out great. I mean, I was able to put in a big raise on the river when I hit the hand, and people were flabbergasted that I had ace-king because they just could never have put me on that because I limped with it. But more often than not, it hasn't worked out for me. But aces, no, I don't play that game. I don't limp with aces. I raise and take their blinds and move on to the next hand.
Yeah, here's the deal. First, he says, I know from experience, slow playing aces is always
a bad idea.
So take your own advice. That's one. Now, I know he says, but in this instance, I really think the only way I'm going to get anything out of them is to slow play them. So here's the deal. There's already 325 in the pot, and you haven't done anything yet. Yeah. No, actually, there's more because you got four players, so there's actually 400 in the pot already. Now, you've only got about 9K. You know, 10% of your stack is 900. You've already increased it 5% if you just raise and take it.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? Two, it looks fishy to me. Yeah. We know O'Malley's a good player. So if O'Malley limps on the button when he's only got the blinds behind him, and we know the blinds are tight, we all know they're tight, we all know they fold, you should have any two cards there in a raising with them. When you don't, it looks fishy anyway. So if they didn't hit the queen, you're gonna lose them anyway. So you've made a lot of mistakes up to this point already based on position, based on past experience, based on these players. So right now you've made too many mistakes, and the slow playing part is not even the worst of them. And then when I agree with you wholeheartedly, that turn, you cannot check that turn. You've already got Queen Jack on that board. Anybody who is coming along could easily have something that goes with that. Two Broadway cards gives them a gut shot. Two of the right Broadway cards gives them an open-ended. I mean, to me, and the fact that she bet, and then you raised, and then she calls, and then you check the turn after that, you know she's got something. When the nine comes now, you could have you beat already.
Well, that's the thing, though. If she checked the turn when the nine came up, if this player had made two pair on the turn, there's no way she's going to check that.
Yeah, especially that coordinated board.
So by her checking the turn, that tells you right there, it's time for you to bet and now take this pot.
Yes.
This pot was yours pre-flop. This pot was yours
post-flop and turn.
Post-flop and turn. You just need to grab it. And the thing about tournaments is, you're right, that chips in the middle, it's not, you know, you're not going to swing a home run every time with aces. You need to just accumulate these chips and take them where you can get them and always make the right play and just, you know, don't be dissatisfied that you're only getting 400 chips or something. That's how tournaments are won, by, you know, continual slow accumulation, and then maybe you wait and hit some home runs with, you know, some hands where you hit the nuts or something. But and he says he later had a bad run of cards. Well, you just got aces.
Yeah.
And you just misplayed aces. So, you know, I'm not having a whole hell of a lot of sympathy with not having cards. That should have been a button raise with any two, I think.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is when he talks about maybe I should have bet there on the turn, but I was concerned with pot control. Well, really, you're the chip leader in a four with four players left, and it pays two. These guys are, you know, I mean, yeah, I understand about pot control, but you're playing four-handed now. You know, yeah. I mean, and you're the chip leader. How badly can this pot get bloated? You know, I mean, she shoved on you after that because she hit her third queen, I would assume. Yeah. You know, she could have had, maybe she could have had king-10, maybe, because she was open-ended and hit it and then checked it to see if you'd bet, and you didn't. Then she goes all in. So it's possible. It's possible she made two pair, but I don't – you know, jacks and queens or something, and you were ahead, but you don't want to take a chance, but I doubt it. Just, she sounds like she hit her third queen or maybe king 10. So I can't imagine not betting that turn when she checks to me after I raise. And then, you know, she came out betting into me. then you're like, okay, so she thinks that I've got a massive hand, and she's not afraid to bend to me, so she must have a better hand. But when she doesn't, you got to put something in there, pot control. No, you can't control every pot size. In this case, you need to protect, not control.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like to me, at least. And that turn was the huge flag for me, the way he played that turn. And, of course, preflop. We talked about that. The whole situation leading up to it, where we know they're tight, and we know that you're on the button, and you've got two tight guys behind you in the blinds,
well,
and you're on the button, raise?
That's the thing. You're playing against two tight players. The only time they're going to play back at you and make a big pot is when they have a good hand.
Exactly. And so that's why you raise.
This would almost make more sense playing this way against two maniacs.
Yeah, that's right.
To limp with aces.
That's right.
Why are you limping with aces the only way you're going to get paid off is if you make the absolute stone cold nuts against somebody who's, these type players are only going to put money in the pot when they've got a big hand. So that should tell you right there that it was the wrong play.
Right, exactly. And if they play back at you, now you've got your aces and you just get it all in with them. Now you would have lost his hand with her if she had, right.
She's not going to call with, queen jack. If first of all, she's folding preflop. So
right, she's tight, folding preflop. You're right.
There's always another hand right around the corner, folks.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Mike, thanks for filling in these last 2 weeks. Really appreciate you
it's
keeping the streak alive.
Yep. And it will still be alive, even when you guys do those shows.
Don't forget to send those in to us, and we'll see what we can do to get your favorite on the show. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Mike Bassett.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.
Who is it?
It's your buddy. What's the matter? You don't like nicknames?
No, I'm all right with that.
I could have said, ready when you are, Lance.
You'd
have been mad at me.
I was just reading the history, and it was like, hey, bud, whenever you're ready, let me know. And then there's another bud on there. And
how about pal? You want me to go with pal?
Pally,
okay.
Pally.
Ready when you are, Pally.
All right.